Hi Martin, first off, could you introduce yourself and tell us what the name of your new book is?
Hi Tom, my name is Martin Johnson. I am the CEO of Trans2 Performance and the author of the first book, I Am Human, 30 Mistakes to Success. And my new book is I Am Human, Pain and Pleasure.
Brilliant. So why this book and why now?
Good question. I wrote the first book in 2017. And the first book, 30 Mistakes to Success, was almost like a battle guide to your psychology. It was 30 unconscious things that we all do. And it was challenging, you know, why do you do them? Do they serve you well? And in what situations and contexts should you apply them? This one has a lot more depth to it. I Am Human, Pain and Pleasure is a natural follow-on to the first book. And it's exploring the psychology behind how everything we do in life, going back hundreds of thousands of years, is governed by our ability to endure pain and suffering or seek pleasure and reward. So it's really breaking down our psychology, our behaviors, our actions, our drivers, the way we respond to situations. It's breaking all of that down and saying, ultimately, we are either trying to avoid pain and discomfort or endure it, or we're trying to seek some form of pleasure and reward. And therefore, all human motivation is either away from pain or towards pleasure. So I wanted to write the book to really simplify this and get people to understand everything that is behind their daily lives, their behaviors, their worries, their troubles, their desires, their elation and triumph. Everything is pain and pleasure.
You talk about how without survival instincts, such as experiencing practical or perceived pain, we become extinct almost instantly. I was wondering if you can speak more to that and the importance of pain.
Yeah, I mean, early on in the book, I talk a lot about evolution and going back to hunter-gatherer ancestors hundreds of thousands of years ago to try and explain how the brain evolved and how this pain and pleasure mechanism worked. And if you think about the life of a hunter-gatherer, it was quite a simple life, although it was probably incredibly dangerous at times and volatile. It was nowhere near as busy or as complex as our lives are today. So if you think about the basic core functions of existence, we have survival, reproduction, find a mate and reproduce, and purpose. What is my role on a day-to-day basis within the tribe? And when you think about those three simple things, pain and pleasure was essential in order for us to survive and evolve. So for example, as part of the cognitive revolution, 70,000 years ago, we had to be able to pass on information to our offspring and our young around the dangers of being a hunter-gatherer. So whether that was a snake bites or a lion kills or those berries poison or fire burns, we were able to pass on that information to the next generations who then passed it on with more information, who then passed that lot on with more information. So with each generation that passed, we became more knowledgeable as a species around pain and around risk and around things that would jeopardize our survival. Mm-hmm. So pain was essential for working out what kills us and what doesn't, what harms us and what doesn't. And around the cognitive revolution, something really interesting happened. For years, we used to be able to experience physical pain when encountering that threat. So if a snake bit you, you would be bitten, realize how much that bloody hurts, realize that afterwards somebody died after the bite. So that information was then built and retained after the event. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened around the cognitive revolution is we then learned, the brain evolved to be able to perceive potential dangers before they even happen. So with all of the information gathering and sharing, I would see the snake from 20 yards and remember, oh no, don't go near that. That's going to bite me and kill me. So being able to transition from experiencing pain and danger in the moment or after the event to foreseeing it and perceiving it was really one of the underlying factors in our dominance as a species.
Brilliant. In the book, you talk about how being a parent changes your relationship with pain and discomfort. I wonder if you could just speak a bit more to that.
Well, I'm sure anybody watching this who is a parent, including yourself, Tom,
yes,
will resonate with this, whether you're a mother or father. And I think if you go back to what I mentioned in the very first few pages of the book around our core functions of human existence, our survival, reproduction, and purpose, you strip us right back, there's really only those three governing factors. Self-preservation, stay alive, continue our species, find a mate and reproduce, and then purpose, whilst I'm here, what's my role? How do I contribute in some way? So what's interesting about that, though, is survival is the number one thing that triggers the brain's fight or flight response. Like I mentioned earlier, whether that was to run away from predators or perceive future threats and dangers, to stay alive. So it's already incredibly powerful, and it already triggers off in the brain in seconds to be able to either fight what's in front of us or get the hell out of there. So then you find a mate and reproduce. And if you even think back to our hunter-gatherer days, our ancestors, once a child enters the tribe, you then assume responsibility for the survival on behalf of that child. You carry the burden of survival because they can't carry it themselves. So what was once a highly tuned early warning radar in the brain to threat for yourself has now been ramped up tenfold because you're trying to carry that burden of survival on behalf of the offspring. Now, if you then times that offspring by two or three, you can understand how the human brain can go from self-preservation to everything around me is now a danger, because you are watching the little ones. You are, let's fast track to modern day life. You know, after having children, you no longer are very relaxed in public spaces, right? You're constantly scanning the horizon, going, walk on the inside of the road, get down from there, chew your food. Everything is a danger, right? So you're almost on high alert all the time. So if there's anybody watching this who has become a parent or has been a parent for some time, and you ever wonder why your levels of anxiety to potential threats and danger has gone through the roof after having children, and your brain's ability to hypothetically worry about the future and what might happen, if you've ever wondered why that goes up, it's because you are carrying the burden of survival on behalf of the children. You're not mad. You're not going out of your mind. It's normal. You're a Homo sapien who was given, who was either reproduced or given birth to offspring, when, and your survival mechanism dial is now higher than it once was. And hopefully, when they fly the nest and become adults, your job is done and your dial will come back down a little bit, hopefully. That's generally the trend we see.
Yeah.
But that's the reason why our ability to endure suffering and experience pain, anxiety, and worry is fully tested more than ever after having children and during parenthood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can agree with that. What is it about modern times that means so many of us have difficulty in finding purpose?
Oh, such a big question. Purpose, I think of the three core functions of existence, survival, reproduction, and purpose. Purpose is now one of the main either enabling factors or inhibiting factors for people in modern day life. Because survival, we've pretty much cracked. Like, if you think about it, we do no longer run from saber-tooth tigers every day, or we're no longer in a life or death situation every single day. Some people have experienced those things. Granted, you know, there are still atrocities in the world and illnesses and things that are life or death. But if you think about the average person on the average day, it's not really life or death every day anymore. So your survival mechanism at a true level is pretty much okay. Reproduction, you know, most people find a mate and reproduce. And if you don't, that's okay. But again, continuity of the species has been something that we've been pretty good at for many years now. But purpose in modern day life is very interesting, because your purpose was very clear back then. It was stay alive, hunt, forage, farm, mate, protect the tribe. Mm-hmm. And within that, you was probably good at one of those skill sets. You was either the forager or the leader or the hunter or the gatherer or the caregiver. And therefore, purposes were quite clearly defined. You fast forward to today. I mean, what is purpose? We have more roles than we've ever had in our entire life. We've got to be a husband, a wife. We've got to be a partner. We've got to be a colleague. We've got to be an auntie, an uncle, a cousin, a niece, a nephew. We've got to be a sports coach. We've got to be a career professional, right? Mm-hmm. We've got to be a hobbyist. We've got so many things in our life. It's cluttered with so many things that we spread ourselves so thinly these days and try to do everything well that sometimes we dilute our ability to understand what our true purpose is. And some people find it in their careers and go, my purpose is I get up and I go to work every day and I love it. Some people probably watching this thinking, I've never felt like that about work. Some people go, being a father or a mother gives me purpose, having my children. And other people say, that's not enough for me. That's like Groundhog Day. I need to exist outside of the identity of being a mother or a father. You know, some people want to run charities, raise money, be a sports coach and give back to the community, to the young kids. There's lots of different things that can constitute purpose. And this is why I always say purpose is different things to different people. But to answer your question, I think it's harder for people to find it these days because we are overwhelmed with both the roles that we play in modern day life. We are diluting our focus on something that's substantial and that means something to us. And I think the one thing we know in psychology is as much as survival can send you into that threat state, as much as survival can create that anxiety and that ill feeling, lack of purpose does exactly the same. Just because you're not experiencing immediate threat or anything traumatic doesn't mean to say that it can harm your mental well-being. If you don't feel like you get up every morning and you've got something to contribute and you go something somewhere that gives you meaning, that equally can upset the balancing the scales of that mental well-being. So purpose is important, but I think we live in a day and an age, and we haven't even talked about the digital world and social media and the influences all of this other stuff has on our brain. But I think people are struggling more than they used to establish what their purpose is, mm-hmm. or what gives them that true fulfillment. And quite often here at T2, that's a lot of the conversations we have when we're engaging in coaching and support.
Yeah, I've just thought of this then, but I guess it sort of comes down to the amount of choice that we have.
We are, you know, overwhelmed with consumption. Mm-hmm. Consumption of information, consumption of materialistic things, mm-hmm. consumption of choices of experience and activities that we can do. And there's a big part of this around, in order to sometimes think and establish purpose through having vision, mm-hmm. and imagination, is being sabotaged by the fact that the younger generations and our children never have a moment where they're sat doing nothing. Mm. Like, for example, my son, he can almost see it in him. If he's not on an iPad or on FIFA or watching YouTube or playing in the garden or doing something or having something to do, it's like he can't sit and cope and just sit in the moment and have a conversation and think. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people would say most kids are like that anyway. But the point being is when we were young, we didn't have all these devices and all the access to Netflix and, you know, on-demand everything. We never had all of this. So you almost had to sometimes get used to doing nothing or then go outside or find something to do.
Yeah.
So I think as I cover in the book, in your neutral state, I call it, that's the time for reflection and imagination to really kick in, which really allows you sometimes to think about what your purpose is. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure we live in a modern day life where we have the time to explore imagination, to reflect on what we're doing, what we have done, what's important to us, and therefore struggle to really find what our purpose is. Mm-hmm. So I think consumption in modern day life, and more choice than ever, it's a wonderful thing in many ways, but it's also a challenge to some of our fundamentals and the way our mind works.
Yeah. Could you give an explanation of challenge and threat states, but also the newly added neutral state, and how it's an important part of the pain-pleasure complex?
So we've talked about challenge versus threat state mindsets for a long time at T2. And for those who are not familiar with it, a challenge state mindset is when you are feeling that something is going to present a risk or a level of uncertainty, or something could go wrong. However, the rewards at the end of it are great enough for you to go and engage and have a go. So a challenge state situation might be giving a presentation at work. Right, you know that it's your chance to shine. You can impress the boss. You can stand up there and deliver a powerful presentation and inspire the room. That's the reward, right? That's the motivation. But what comes with that is this risk and uncertainty around, what if it goes wrong? What if I start sweating? I start mumbling? What if I forget my words? What if I can't feel the questions? You're going to look bad, inferior. People are going to laugh at you. Your credibility is going to be questioned, right? So a challenge state situation is something where you are motivated by the potential of the reward and outcome. It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. So there is something for you in it, but it absolutely still carries, it triggers that survival mechanism because it carries a level of risk or uncertainty or consequence. A threat state is simply hardwired through evolution, where we perceive that we are in immediate threat or danger, or something poses an immediate threat or danger to us. And in a threat state, we just want to get the hell out of there, right? Mm-hmm. Or we want to fight it and deal with it. And you know, what was once very clear as a threat state was clear and immediate danger. We live in a modern day world now where there's very few things. Like, I always ask people questions around, tell me the last time you was in immediate and clear danger. And they can't answer me. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is most things we face in modern day life do not present an immediate danger to our existence. They just don't. But the brain's very clever at still sending you into a threat state instead of a challenge state in situations and scenarios that are not going to kill you. The presentation at work, having an uncomfortable conversation with a friend or family member if there's some conflict, you know, even getting on a plane or walking over a bridge or swimming in open water. Now, some of those things could present an immediate threat and danger, but the likelihood is very unlikely, but your brain can't decipher between this.
Yeah.
So challenge and threat state is a fine line for some people sometimes. What other people determine, this is a challenge and I'm up for it and I've calculated the risks and it's fine. Other people's brains will go into overdrive and say, this is going to kill you. This is bad. Get yourself out of there. But what I talk about in the book is there is a third state. And the third state is what we call the neutral state, because life's not all about you're either in threat and in survival mode, or you're up for the challenge and your adrenaline's pumping and you're pushing yourself. Sometimes you're just sat in your comfort zone. And the comfort zone is where you're content. You're neither under challenge and trying to take on endeavors, and you're also neither feeling threatened, worried, or anxious. The neutral state is that time where you sit content, happy, comfortable. You're recharging and resetting the system, and you're busy doing nothing. I talk in the book about being busy doing nothing. And what we've found in our studies and in the people we work with is that the neutral state is far more important than people think. You know, people think it's about just wasting time. It's non-productive. Mm. Some people say to me, laying in bed in the morning on a weekend, having a coffee until 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock is just a waste of time. It's non-productive. Mm. I'm up 6 a.m. in the day. I'm at them and I'm thinking, brilliant. And if that works for people, that works. But if your neutral state time, because you're busy all week, is a Saturday and a Sunday morning with a coffee in bed, then you must protect that time at all costs. Because our ability to do nothing and reset and recharge our batteries and neither being challenge or threat is incredibly important. And scientifically, the neuroscience of what your brain is doing in neutral state, the benefits of that are absolutely clear.
Yep.
So if that makes sense, I always like to say to people, think of your psychological states as three different states. You can either be in your neutral state, which is very important. You're neither challenged, nor you either in threat mode or under survival. Challenged state, you're taking on an endeavor, you're pushing yourself, it carries some risk or consequence, but there's a reward at the end of it. And threat state, your brain's gone into overdrive and you feel like you want to get out of there or deal with the situation. You feel that there is, for whatever reason, an immediate or clear threat to you, even if that's perceived or real.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. There's two parts to this next question. How would you define high and low road motivation? And then further to that, you identify that we can find ourselves in a perpetual cycle of comfort and ease. What can we do to break that pattern and balance the scales?
So low road motivation versus high road motivation. I created this and wrote it in the book for a reason, because I wanted a really simple way of people to understand the difference between the choices they make on a daily basis. So low road motivation is, if you take the low road motivation activities are the things that deliver instant or very quick gains, gratification or rewards for very little effort. Mm-hmm. And if you think about that, when I say that, you're thinking, give me that all day long, right? The low road is the place to be. High road motivation is where you're probably going to have to offer some significant contribution, energy and effort. You're going to have to take on a challenge. The results are delayed. The gratification might not come instantly, but down the line and further down the line, when it does come, it's likely to be more beneficial. So I'll give you an example of this. You need to get in shape. Right, you decide as a human being you need to do something about your fitness. So I'll give you an example of this. You need to get in shape. You need to develop your fitness. You've decided you need to do something about it. So the high road motivation option, right, your brain does a bit of a calculation, comes up with two options. The high road motivation option is join the gym. It's going to cost you £100 a month. You're going to have to train 3 to 4 times a week. Roughly 5 hours commitment. You're going to have to eat well to complement it. You're going to have to sleep well and sacrifice some of your nights out and your social life. And guess what? It's not going to happen overnight. You're probably not going to see the gains and the benefits for weeks, months even. But if you do this at the end of it, the results you will get will be magnificent. The results you will get will be worth it. You will, without question, change the levels of your fitness and achieve your desired outcome. However, the low road motivation alternative quickly comes into the brain. Forget all of that. It's £100 a month. It's 5 hours a week. It's the gym. It's arduous. You're never going to be able to keep it up. Just go on Amazon, right? Search for some products, and within 5 minutes, I've got an abs machine and some weight loss pills. The low road motivation alternative wins again. And you can think of so many examples in modern day life of low road versus high road. You know, you leave work, you're tired, you're trying to eat healthy. You've got to stop off at the supermarket and get some groceries and get some fresh produce. You're going to go home and cook yourself a nice meal, but it'll be worth it because it'll be healthy, it'll be nutritious. Then you've got the cleanup operation afterwards, right? It's a rigmarole. It's going to take another hour out of your evening, high road option. Low road option tells your brain, nah, just go home, order a takeaway on Just Eat. It'll be at the doorstep in 10 minutes and it'll taste amazing. We'll start tomorrow. Yeah. The low road will be the high road every time, because we live in a world now where the opportunity to have an instant result, even if it's detrimental to our mental and physical well-being, the option is there. And evolution has hardwired us a little bit to preserve energy for when we need it. So if we can get a result for very little energy and preserve that energy, the brain wants to do it. Because who wants to do the arduous stuff that's going to be incredibly tasking? So when I talk about low road versus high road in the book, I'm challenging the reader to reflect on their life and say, am I a low road motivation machine? Am I getting caught up in choosing the easy path for instant gratification, but probably little reward, or maybe even it could be detrimental to my health in the future, versus the high road motivation stuff that isn't going to give me what I need in the here and now? It's going to mean I have to offer a significant contribution towards it, and I've got to be able to delay my gratification to further down the line. I find that this is a really interesting psychological problem that we have in modern day society, and I think we need to find the balance with the low and the high road if we're going to re-establish mental well-being in the future.
Are you tired of the mundane and ready to plunge headfirst into the dynamic world of leadership and development? If you answered with an emphatic yes, then we want you to join the Trans2 Performance team as our newest senior consultant. We are creating a world-class learning and development consultancy, working with a wide scope of exciting sectors, including private, public, armed forces, and elite sports.
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
Tap into your unique style to support clients and cohorts as they navigate the complexities of leadership and development challenges, delivering T2 content with passion and precision. Interested? Apply and send us a 3-minute video that is as bold as your spirit. Let us know why you think you'd be a good fit at T2, what you love about what we do, and send a cover letter that lets us see your experience. Please note, this role will be based in Hull, East Yorkshire, and you should be expected to work from the office when not travelling to clients. Remote variations are not available at this time due to the amount of collaborative work we undertake. Ability to travel around the UK and internationally when required, and you must have use of a car.
Could you speak on what determines our personality types, characteristics, and traits, despite us all sharing the same 3 core functions of existence?
So this is the moment in the book where I transition from talking about Homo sapiens as a species and as we've evolved as a species, where we, as an animal, we all share the same core functions, survival, reproduction, and purpose. But of course, as we all know, we are all weirdly and wonderfully different. And so this is the part in the book where I transition to how your unique personality type is formed. And yes, that's the core we are built on, survival, reproduction, purpose. Yes, we're an animal with the same biology and similar biology. But we all have these unique quirks, traits, characteristics, and attributes. And that fundamentally comes from your nature and nurture. So I write a whole chapter in the book on nature versus nurture. And simply put, your nature is the genes passed down to you by your parents. You get 50% from mother, 50% from father. And you know, that's really important. That's your sort of baseline starting point from birth. That will govern some of the fundamental things like skin color, eye color, hair color, height, you know, body shape. All of that physical genetic stuff will be largely be determined by your genetics. There's also elements of your behaviors and characteristics that can be passed on through genes. So you've already got a bit of a starting point, believe it or not, when it comes to you developing your behaviors, characteristics, and personality style through genetic coding. However, the other part of it is your nurture. So after birth and growing up and through your early stages of brain development, and the brain typically develops by the time you're 23 to 26 years old. Some people it's later, some people it can be slightly earlier, but let's say between 23 to 26 years old. So those formative years are really influential on your personality style forming. And within the nurture element, you're really looking at 3 main influences that start to form these characteristics and attributes and your personality, which is parental, the way your parents view, and I talk a whole segment in the book about parental influence. Social, where you grow up, the friends you knock around with, the relationships you have, the hobbies and interests you had as a child, and the experiences. and educational, your school years and your educational influences. This forms your environment. And parental, social, and educational are also combined with those genes you've inherited from mother and father, all go into the pot to you forming a personality type. And that's why some of us are extroverted, expressive, larger than life, risk takers, and others are risk averse, introverted, prefer their own company, you know. And we arrive at that point primarily through your nature and nurture and the complex combination between genes and environment.
Brilliant. What forms our worldview and what questions should we ask ourselves if we want to discover ours?
The chapter in the book that I think will provoke the reader the most is the worldview chapter. And having coached thousands of people and sat in one-to-ones with so many people, I can almost pinpoint that the root cause of anybody's temporary issues, problems, challenges, whatever it might be, stems from their view of the world. So what is a worldview? A worldview is the way in which you see the world, how it operates, the framework it's built on, right? And the second part of the worldview is to what degree you agree with that. So a worldview is made up of elements. And I can ask five key questions as an example that would draw out the way somebody sees the world. We get deep with this, Tom. The first big question that will form your worldview is, how do you believe the world was created? Do you believe it was the Big Bang, science and evolution and organisms, or do you believe it in faith and it was created by God? And the reason that question is important is because depending on what you fundamentally believe, and some people believe in a mixture of the two, but depending on what you believe, starts to form the way you see the world that you operate within. Like if you fundamentally believe it was organic through science, Big Bang and evolution, then already the way you operate within the world is going to be massively different to if you think that it was created by God and you're a religious person and you follow that faith. That's going to send you in two completely different directions from the outset. And then there's things like political standpoints. Do you believe in capitalism and governments and rules and governance? Or do you believe more in socialism and that we should all be equal and we should look after everybody on the planet and there should be no power in the world and the rich and powerful shouldn't exist? You know, depending on which side of the fence you sit on there will also govern the way you operate within the world and form your views and the way you act and react to situations. What are your values and motivations in life? What happens to us when we die? Is there something after this, or are we just an organism who dies off? These might seem really deep, fundamental questions, and you can take the T2 Worldview Survey, which asks you a lot of questions in these types of areas, and it will come out with the elements that you score highly on. So, for example, I score highly in my testing of worldview on humanism. So I believe in science, the Big Bang and evolution as to how the world was created. I score highly on individualism. So I believe that I control what I do in the world as an individual. I think I can have the power to make decisions and take action in any situation. I definitely have thought long and hard over my life around the system of the world. Capitalism is something that has always existed. It's something that actually does make the world produce and tick, in my opinion. I don't think we've found a better system yet. So instead of resenting it or being for it, I just operate within it and say, right, what is the way I'm going to succeed within a system of capitalism? So I look at all these things and I'm very clear. I'm an optimist, so I score highly on optimism. I'm not pessimism. So I believe that there's always a way and that we can do things and you can achieve anything you want to. So I score on all these things. Now, what that says to me is that I've got a worldview that is largely aligned with the reality of the way the world works. Now, that is not right or wrong. That's just the way I see it. So if I'm more aligned, then I focus my energy and efforts on how I'm going to live and operate within that system. And that works for me. That really works for me. But if you had a worldview that was collectivism, not individualism, where you believe everything should be done for the good of all, then the reality of the way the world works is not in complete alignment with that element of your worldview. So it can cause frustration, ill feeling, resentment. Right? It could trigger you every single day when other people are not displaying collectivism. Right?
Yeah.
And so the worldview is really important. And I would encourage people watching this to take the test. Read the book first and then take the test, because it will give you at a fundamental level the way you see the world, the way you believe it was created, the way you believe it's operated, to what degree you agree with that. That's a really important question, because you might see the world working in a certain way and you might completely disagree with it, which means you are potentially going to be triggered, challenged, and in threat state every single day. Every single day, which is a really important point I make in the book. And it's worth saying that there's no right or wrong with worldview. You view the world in a way because of some fundamental reasons. Your nature, your upbringing, your religious beliefs or your scientific beliefs, your moral positions. You view the world in a certain way. There's no right or wrong. But what I'm asking readers to do is reflect on what yours is and ask yourself the question, is it serving you well? And if it is, good. And if it's not, what tweaks can you make, or how can you rethink and reposition some of these elements so it does serve you well? And there's always tweaks we can make. Mm-hmm. So if that explains it, I think it will be the most provocative part of the book, but I think it's an essential part that people need to connect with.
Mm-hmm.
What is the way I view the world? And to what degree do I agree with it? And is it serving me well?
Mm-hmm. Could you touch on the key attributes and characteristics for enduring pain and discomfort?
Yes. So, attributes for enduring pain and discomfort. Well, as humans, we're going to need a couple of things. And I talk about these particular ones in the book. I mean, the reality is there's many different characteristics and attributes that can come to the fore when we're trying to endure difficult periods of our life, or when we're trying to take on endeavors that are difficult, or just endure general pain, anxiety, worries, and tough periods. But the first thing you're going to need is courage. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It's the ability to step into a situation despite it. And courage is needed. It's always been needed, but it's needed every day to some extent. And when we do testing on people around characteristics, traits, motivators, and attributes, we know that some people have natural high levels of courage. They've built it over time. It's a combination of their genes, and they might have inherited certain traits and characteristics through their genetic biochemistry, but also through hardships, through environment, through upbringing. Some people develop levels of courage, so by the time they reach adulthood, they've got it in abundance. Other people, not so. And that's not a bad thing. Some people are low on courage or moderate on courage. And that's okay. That's okay. Sometimes low courage serves you well. And that's for another video. But sometimes there is situations where being overly high on courage can get you in trouble,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So low and moderate on courage is not a problem. It's just recognizing if you are, and knowing that you are going to need a level of it at times to endure pain and discomfort, to step into something knowing it's going to be uncomfortable or challenging. That takes courage. The second thing you're going to need once you step into it is you're going to have a level of durability. I talk in the book about durability. Durability, if courage is your ability to step into something despite it being potentially painful and or uncomfortable, courage is your ability to endure it once you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's mental or physical pain, staying in something that your brain is telling you to stop or get out of there is alien to us as a species. But those people who carry on with endeavors, who can sit in pain and discomfort, display high levels of durability beyond the brain's natural pain threshold, which I talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I give some really helpful tips in the book around what do the elite athletes we work with, the senior leaders in pressurized organizations, or the people in the emergency services who are responding to quite stressful situations, what do they do the most that allows them to be more durable than the average human being? Mm-hmm. The third thing you're going to need is a persistence. You're going to have to be persistent, as in you come away from that first exposure to the stressful event, and the temptation is for your brain to go, never do that again. That was traumatizing. Mm-hmm. So you've shown courage to go in it. You've shown durability to stay in it. But if you come away and you haven't got persistence, you will never go back into that situation again, and you will see it as a bad experience. Persistence says, despite that being incredibly uncomfortable, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to persist in engaging in these situations and activity until I can desensitize myself to its effects. So persistence is a really important part of it. And so there's three that I would say straight off the bat are important. The final one I will mention, because I won't mention them all, but the final one I'll talk about in the book is resilience. People think resilience is all of the stuff I've just talked about. Courage, durability, persistence. No, they're different things. Resilience is your ability to bounce back to your baseline mental state after the exposure. Mm-hmm. So I come away from something. It's been traumatic. It's been difficult. It's been hard. I've endured it. My brain is saying, don't ever do that again. My resilience is my ability to calm my system, not catastrophize it, bring my mental state back to my baseline in order for me to think rationally, and then I can display that persistence to go again. Some people don't have high resilience. They don't bounce back quickly. It affects them for a long period of time, which then can have the opposite effect. So I talk in the book about how you get back to baseline and some techniques you have to do to calm the system after an exposure of enduring pain in order to be able to go again.
Brilliant. What are some actions we can all take to balance the scales of enduring pain and experiencing pleasure?
Oh, how long have you got, Tom? So there's a whole final chapter on this in the book around balancing the scales, because ultimately the message of the book is this. If we are going to continue to dominate as a species for another 100,000 years, we need to be able to endure pain and discomfort in equal measure and as much as seeking pleasure and reward. My belief, through scientific evidence, research and study, through our experiences of working with people here, through the data we have on mental health declining in the younger generations, specifically, we know that them scales have tipped, and we are not enduring pain and discomfort like we once did. And in fact, we're trying to overcompensate on seeking pleasure and reward. So we've got to balance the scales. Mm-hmm. So the whole last chapter is called Balancing the Scales, and how do we do that? I talk about a few things in the book. I talk about habituation and how we over-habituate on dopamine-releasing activities. So we're altering the dopamine system in the brain. We're reducing our overall levels, which over time reduces our ability to experience the same level of pleasure that we once did from that activity, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And yeah. there's a lot of science that goes behind it, and a lot of the environmental factors in modern day life that are triggering it and supercharging it. Mm-hmm. So I talk about pulling back on habituation. The things, you know, things that have a high addictive liability specifically. So high addictive liability is activities that trigger extreme amounts of dopamine in the brain, and therefore it feels amazing, so it becomes a high addictive liability. The likelihood of you becoming addictive is higher on these activities because of the way also it engages with the brain. So examples of physical things would be substance abuse, like alcohol or drugs. You know, they have a potent effect on the brain in terms of the hit you have. You can't experience anywhere else. So they have high addictive liability. Andrew Huberman in the Huberman Lab talks a lot about like non-addictive substance, well, not class A drugs or alcohol or cigarettes, but he talks about chocolate, for example. Chocolate has a high addictive liability. It's why we love it so much. It's not good for us, but as soon as you eat a bar of chocolate, you might be full, but you want another one, or you want another cube. So there's different things that have a high addictive liability. But what I talk about in the book the most is, what about the digital drugs? What about online activities such as gambling, gaming, social media, pornography, right? They all have a high addictive liability, which means that we access them more frequently. The more times we hit them, the more it affects the dopamine system until the point at which we are so depleted that we no longer get the same pleasure from repeating that activity. So to balance the scales, we've got to reduce the habituation we have on dopamine releasing activities with a high addictive liability, because we have them on offer in abundance every single day, and it's altering our ability to experience pleasure and reward like we once did. I talk about and revisit high road motivation, particularly in this chapter. We've got to push more into discomfort. We've got to choose the high road consciously. You know, if you're on the 9th floor of a building, and you've got the option of taking the stairs or high road, it's going to have to be some effort to get up 9 flights of stairs. You're going to be tired. It's going to take you 3 times as long. Mm-hmm. Or you get in the lift and you press 9 and you're there in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Low versus high road. We're going to have to push it. And that's a very simple example, but you get my point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ask yourself the question, what types of high road challenge do you have in your life right now to put yourself in the exposure where you're going to have to endure some pain and discomfort? If we're going to get the balance right, we have to purposely push into that while dishabituating on the low road alternatives, especially those with high addictive liability. And there's many, many more elements I talk about, Tom, but I won't reveal the whole book.
Yeah.
But it's getting people to think about their lifestyles, their routines, their choices, and going, am I achieving this balance or not? If you're at a stage in life where you just want to reassess a few things and want to understand the inner workings of you, then I would encourage you to read the book also, because there's a few links to online tests that I get you to take from the book, which really draw out some of these things like your personality type, your attributes, your worldview. So if anything, it gives you the tools to be able to build a picture of understanding of what's making you tick and what's influencing your decisions and your actions and your mindset. And hopefully it will encourage you to make a couple of adjustments or a couple of assessments of what's serving you well and what's not. If that helps people, job done.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much.
Cheers, Tom.